being knowledgeable about psychiatry and these kinds of concerns, he asked me a rhetoric question. Cy, who wired your brain? The answer is obviously God did. Does your brain have the ability to become addicted? Yeah, isn't that right? Who made that possible? God? Okay, that's the point. And he said, the fact is, biochemically, you are wired by God to gravitate toward any source of pleasure. This is the basis of addiction. Eating a chocolate candy bar, we are wired to experience pleasure. Here's my point, now listen. Not every pleasure is addictive, to be sure. There are many pleasures around us, like chocolate. I'm not addicted to chocolate. I can stop anytime I want. But the point is, do you know why chocolate is pleasurable? Well, inherently, the way I am wired and the substance and its flavor, automatically when I taste it, I don't have to be convinced that it tastes good. Generally, chocolate is a straightforward flavor that provides a level of pleasure, and that is permanently biochemically etched as an association that you will never, even if you never eat chocolate again, you will never forget that it tasted good. Some pleasures must be cultivated. For example, tasting wine or maybe smoking a cigar, these are considered high pleasures by some, but generally they are not inherently flavorful and pleasurable first go. You have to, through repetition, create a cultivated taste. Isn't that right? And yet, once you enjoy those pleasures, they can become quite dominant, even controlling, thus alcoholism. Would you agree? And so we are wired by God to gravitate naturally toward varying things that give us pleasure. No wonder he wants to be first in our lives as a source of pleasure emotionally, relationally, because then that becomes an anchor to keep us on a leash from being controlled from the other possible pleasures out there that would have appeal to us. Would you agree? So consequently, many Christian people think that they are bad because they still have that element of want to tugging at them on the inside. They feel bad because they think holy people should never struggle or have these feelings or tensions anymore. When God has not suggested that. What God has suggested is that when you struggle, when there's tension, when there is desire, that you submit it to God and that He is your anchor and leash so that the pleasures don't sweep you away. Because gravitate toward them for a while, you very well may, due to biology. People call it the old war with the flesh. Well, it isn't war with your flesh as much as it is war with your brain chemistry, because this is where this is your real sexual equipment here. This is where you feel orgasm. This is where you experience pleasure. Isn't that right? And so consequently, patterns that are deeply ingrained, they don't go anywhere, and the blood of Jesus does not wash them away. But God does give you the opportunity to build new patterns. We'll talk about this later. So, fifth, finally, here we have the problem of people who wrestle with gender insecurity. And to describe this for you, when I put up the image of myself, 22 years ago, when I was living as a woman in preparation for a sex change, which I did not have, God intervened in my life. Pretty obviously, that would be an extreme illustration of gender insecurity. But gender insecurity may be more common than you realize and occurs across a spectrum. Over here is the extreme end where we would have the transsexual and the transvestite. People who have outward evident gender conflict going on. Transvestism is very different than transsexualism. But both reflect a real problem in gender identity. And both are rooted in basic insecurity in gender. One is not confident about one's gender. But moving backward, what we also find is that right about here would be the homosexual concern, because many therapists, though it's terribly politically incorrect to say it, many therapists still view homosexuality as a crisis in identity. And then you move into the heterosexual realm, and you still have lots of insecurity-based problems that affect sex in marriage, commitment in marriage, and parenting of children, and the ability to relate even as a single person to other people. Are you with me? And so, for example, now God does not want every woman to be a Barbie doll. I love Barbie. She's a fabulous icon for our civilization, isn't she? Plastic woman. And as I always say, remember, men, Ken is just an accessory. Anyway. But you know, the thing about it is, while God may not want every woman to be a frilly, lacy Barbie doll, and some women, naturally, that's who they are. But many women are not. Some women are sporty and athletic, and some women are academic and analytical, and all can be women who feel good about themselves, provided they get the right nurture. But there are millions of women, even in the family of faith, who view their womanhood not as a blessing from God and His very best. They view it as a burden to be endured that puts them at risk for mistreatment. Now, don't you think God has better than that? But a lot of women don't know what that feels like. And they may not be lesbian, they may not be transvestite, they may not be transsexual. They may not have that kind of extreme insecurity, identity concern. They may be more over here, but still the way that they relate to men and other women and to their children is affected by not feeling good about themselves as women. Are you with me? God may not want every man to be an Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. I mean, I sometimes get mistaken for Arnie these days in airports around the world, and it's a burden that I bear. But, and of course, I love Arnold because Arnold is just who he is, isn't he? The most potent symbols of masculinity in filmdom. Generally, they're the men who feel the most secure, or at least that's the image they depict. They can mock themselves and do a good send-up of their masculinity. They don't mind to interact with homosexuals on screen and all these kinds of things because they are basically putting forth an image that they're secure. You know, a secure heterosexual man may not think that homosexuality is normal. He may find it perverse and abnormal. But he doesn't have a conflict and feel the need to mistreat gay people. Because, see, if he's secure about himself, he doesn't have to make a statement to everybody or himself. Do you follow me? There are many men, however, they may, you know, not all men are going to be Arnie. Some men are going to be butch and athletic. But that's just one type. Other men are going to be academic and analytical. In fact, they're probably a little more important to the way life actually functions. And some men are going to be artistic, empathetic, and intuitive, of which most pastoral caregivers and musicians and people like that come from. The point is, all of them can be godly, secure, confident men, depending on how they are nourished and nurtured to feel good about themselves. But there are millions of men in the world, even in the church. They're not gay. They're not transsexual, but there are millions of men who do not feel good about themselves as men, and that makes them abusive, controlling, manipulative, domineering husbands, or it makes them men who run away from commitment and not able to serve their families. It makes men passive and insecure in the way that they respond to their children. That's what gender insecurity is like on a spectrum. Are you following me? Don't you think God has better than that? Because whether one's Arnie or not, everybody, every man should be able to feel good about himself as a man. Be confident about himself as a man. There are millions of men who don't know what that feels like. And they live their lives trying to prove to everybody, and especially themselves, see, aren't I a man? The guy who goes out and sleeps with 5 girls a week, you know, he may be a real stud muffin under some categories. But the fact is, real men don't have to use or abuse anybody to prove that they're men. The girl who's flaunting and sensual, who goes out, you know, trying to score with the guys and who's, you know, turning all the guys on as she walks down the street. Oh, she may be celebrated in some elements of culture, like a Marilyn Monroe type of figure. But real women who are secure and confident about themselves don't need to get that necessary kind of attention. They don't have to be bedded with everybody to be found valuable, desirable. Does that make sense? But people who are very insecure have something to prove. Do I make sense? So, I do want to say about the transsexual situation for a moment. I know many transsexuals, but I know 10 in particular. I want to share their experience with you. I know 6 men who became women through surgery. And I know 4 women who became men through surgery. Now, I've met them in various continents, in various decades, in different parts of the world in my ministry travels. They don't know each other. I'm the common touch point as I travel around and they contact me. The point is, I've accumulated these 10 stories, and it's quite an interesting revelation indeed. In each of these 10 cases, they got saved after having had sex changes. Now, what does that say? Having a sex change does not disqualify you from salvation. Right? Secondly, several of them, at the time they got saved, immediately rejected and abandoned their sex-changed effort. And they returned to their original gender. Which also says having a sex change is not necessarily a one-way ticket. You may alter your body, but that's just physical. What you think of yourself is the real issue. And in each of these 10 cases, eventually, they all returned to their original gender identity. Nobody made them do it. Nobody said, you better do it. God brought conviction over time to each of them. This is not my opinion. This is their story. That they felt his best had not been accomplished through the surgery. One of them became one woman who became a man, lived as a man for 10 years. She married a woman. They lived and went to church. And for all intent and purposes, you would have never known this was their journey. Then he, who is actually she, got convicted that this was not God's best. That God loved her. God wanted her. She was saved. That's not the concern. But if she really ever wanted to grow and know God's best, then she should stop running from her original gender, make peace with the issue and the issues that caused her to reject it, and move forward. Now, no pastor or counselor told her what to do. I think that's nobody's place to quite do that. And see, what happens for many Christian workers, and just Christians in general, we try to argue with people. You shouldn't do that, and God said don't to. And you know what? That's like rubber bullets bouncing off a person's forehead. It's not going to work. I don't care how right, morally, theoretically, you might be. The fact is, you won't win the argument with the transsexual. These are people who are deeply unhappy. They want the conflict to end. And this is the perceived source of happiness. And you will not talk them out of it. And if you try, you will burn the relationship communication bridge. Because they view life in one of two ways. You are with me or you are against me. The end. My goal is not to win an argument at the expense of my neighbor. I'm going to treat my neighbor like I'd want. I'm going to offer understanding. Now, as a pastor, when I was based in Singapore, which is a big sex change capital, we would have clients come in who have been transsexed, some pursuing surgery, some having already obtained it. And I did not disqualify them from church participation, but I had to put some boundaries on them because they're not the only person we have to think about. Some of them wanted to work with children. The parents were not comfortable. We had to decline them. Find another ministry to serve other people. I am sorry. It doesn't matter whether you should be allowed to work with children or not. The parents' first primary instinct is to protect their children. They're not comfortable having you work with them. Work somewhere else. Secondly, we had to figure out if they were not yet transsexed. That means they did not yet have legal identity to say that they were like a woman if they had been a man. So the women were not happy with a still male person coming into the restroom. So we had to sort out little inconvenient realities like which bathroom will we have them go to. But those are minor and they are surmountable. The issue is, I want that person to walk with God. That's what matters to me. And if they need to be illumined by God, well, then I want to provide an environment where they can obtain illumination from God. Because my desire is, at the end of the day, that they connect with God so deeply that if God doesn't want them to have a sex change, then it's God's responsibility to let them know. At best, I can offer them support as a pastor toward God and maybe offer them some options. What are the options? You can have a sex change and walk on with God, or after the sex change, maybe you'll think that you've made a mistake. Well, it's not too late. There are people who have sex changes and they reverse. And then in these 10 illustrations I've given you, at some point in their walk with God, they reversed and God spoke the same scripture to them. I conclude, because all 10 of them in different parts of the world heard the same scriptural reference given to them. Isaiah chapter 56 and Acts chapter 8. Isaiah chapter 56 says, don't let the eunuch. Now, who's a eunuch? A man who had his sex organs removed. If you worked for royalty thousands of years ago, that was the common employment practice. Aren't you glad it's not that way in government now? Anyway, although sometimes I look at U.S. Congress and I wonder, well, anyway, might be a good thing. Anyway, it says in this passage of Isaiah chapter 56, don't let the eunuch say, I'm a dry and unproductive tree. You obey my commandments, says the Lord, and you will have a special place in my house. Right there, having your body altered does not disqualify you from God. Secondly, same standard God asks of everybody applies to them. You obey my commandments. You belong. Then in Acts chapter 8, the first missionary to take the gospel to the continent of Africa was a man whose sex organs had been removed, the eunuch. And he, by divine appointment, had the encounter with God's disciple, who then baptized him, and off he went. So again, in the New Testament model, here we have an illustration that having your body altered did not disqualify you from both salvation and work for God. Is that right? It goes to show you that having your body altered isn't the rest of the story. And I knew of a transsexual, this person was not my client, but I knew of this transsexual who committed suicide as a Christian because they thought that they had made the ultimate mistake and that God was mad at them. And the Bible does not say this. The Bible does tell us in Deuteronomy chapter 22 not to cross-dress, with the implication of the scripture meaning to deceive others about your gender. If you're a man, be a man. If you're a woman, be a woman. But at the same time, there is true gender identity confusion for people. I will also tell you that many in the medical profession of psychiatry and specific surgical interventions related to transsexualism, many of them do not support the sex change. There are many in the medical professions who do not view the sex change as valid. There is still controversy about the ethics of this. Research reveals that many, many transsexuals pop out of their belief that they are the member of the opposite sex. Eventually, they pop out of this belief that they're a member of the opposite sex. They come out of like a delusional spell, according to some. They come out of it, but they do have a history of popping out of this. And then you've been a doctor who helped them have a sex change. And so as one of the more famous therapists in North America who specializes in sexual themes, very famous doctor in North America, sent me a quote, and he said, I can use it anytime I want. He said that, you know, a sex change could actually be grounds for malpractice cases in some cases. Because if you're a doctor, even with good intent, you do not offer the transsexual more options. But you just say, oh, you're a transsexual and we'll get you a sex change. And then 10 years later, they pop out of their delusional thinking. Then even though your intent was good, you've aided and abetted them running further from their original gender. Because many transsexuals do respond to non-surgical means of therapy. And so that's why, you know, just because you're a transsexual doesn't mean you automatically get a sex change. Because a lot of times, especially today in the media, which is so complicit with more of a left-leaning liberal view in the politically correct age we live in, you don't get the rest of the story presented, and neither do many transsexuals, because even many therapists are rather railroaded to presenting only the more liberal option. Do I make sense? So, but isn't it nice to know that God's really big, bigger than maybe we give him credit, and that even having a sex change isn't an obstacle to God, really? It's nice. Now, did I see a question? Well, for example, in my experience, we would have transsexuals in our church, and I would tell them when people start talking about, oh, that person's a transsexual, then I feel it is my appropriate pastoral responsibility to call them in. I might not confront them otherwise. I would probably not initiate going up to them and saying, are you a man or a woman? I think that would be rather insensitive. But I think that when people in the church begin talking, then it is my role as the shepherd to step in and say, I need to talk with you. This is what I've heard. First, I want you to know, I don't care. If you're seeking God, I'm here to support you. I want you here. And if what they're saying is not true, then let's nail that rumor. But if there is truth, I want you to know, then my desire is that you grow in God. Because obviously, if you've struggled in these ways, your life has been difficult and painful. And naturally, I think God would love to minister to you and help you sort things out. So that would be my first thing. If people are talking, I'm going to go and talk with this person. Then, secondly, I'd say that probably some education in the family of faith could be really, really useful, that we would need to begin to educate the church, and whether the transsexual wants to be there for that or not, I would tell the transsexual, I'm going to need to start addressing this in the church, that people can have an understanding of where we're going as a family in regard to this concern. And then, thirdly, you know, what could I do to support this transsex person? What are your questions? What are your concerns? Are you getting help? Are you struggling alone? Are you getting medical treatment? You don't have to answer those questions, but I'm wanting to ask them that if I can support you in some way, I'm not going to tell others, but this is what I'd like. These are the questions I have. How can I serve you? And then fourthly, there will be boundaries here in this church that I will not endorse you to get married. If the government says you get to have a new identity card and you get to take on the status of new gender, then I will endorse that and support you. And if you want to use the women's restroom and you've got your new identity card, well, then there you go. But the fact is, I don't feel confident in the Lord to affirm you getting married in a romantic relationship. And if you want to do that, I will not marry you. And that's my personal conviction. I'm not making it somebody else's. That's my stand. I believe that the attempt of the reassignment is to be therapeutic. It is not necessarily to actually say this person is now a woman. It is to enable the person to feel more in sync with their physical packaging. And so That's why I would not allow them, I shouldn't say allow, I would not marry them. Okay? Now, we're talking about a transsexual here. We're not talking about someone who may have had a biologic condition that needs to be specified through surgery, like a hermaphrodite, who may have ambiguous genitals or double set of genitals, where there would be an appropriate place for sex specification surgery. That's a different situation altogether. Transsexuals historically have no biological problems, and genetically, hormonally, physiologically, they are normal people, except for the fact that they don't believe that they're in sync with their body. Okay? And so because this is also a medical condition proven, a psychological condition proven, where some transsexuals pop out of the belief that they're of the opposite sex, then I don't want to encourage them into relationship complexities that may have to be affected then should they pop out of their belief. They're a woman trapped in a man's body. Are you with me? And so, you know, marriage involves not just one other person and their desires. It involves the community. And that's why I feel that I have to have those boundaries. But I appreciate your question. Did I kind of answer it? Yes, as in the case I illustrated earlier. And then they break up. I would say, you know, if you want to just look at it from the 100 million year point of view God has. Yes, today is messy. It's like giving birth. Labor is of God's design. But delivering a baby is painful and messy and traumatic for both parties. But you know what? The wounds mend, and in light of the big picture, a life for eternity has been brought into the world. And I feel that when God must bring correction into our lives sometimes, the fallout in the short term is terribly messy, inconvenient, painful. But the wounds do mend. The messiness does clear up. The murky waters become clear again. And there's where we need to stand with people and believe in the bigger picture with them. That yes, this is a loss, and yes, this is tragic, and yes, this is painful, and maybe you built a life on this artificial identity, and you know what? God knew all about it. He's still with you. He's going to bring you through. This is not the rest of the story. And having hope about that, and it's a real hope, can help people who don't see light at the end of the tunnel be supported that there is. And it's not the rest of the story. Let's find out what it is. Others have blazed that trail. You can get there too. So that's encouraging for strugglers to understand. Mm-hmm. Right. But, of course, in Mrs. Doubtfire, though there were two signals being sent, a secret agenda under the obvious agenda that was more palatable to the masses, I think that, you know, raising questions with our children, this is the world that we live in. Cross-dressing is a part of entertainment. It has been a part of our culture for years, and it will not go away. And then there is transsexualism, and there are men who act like women and women who act like men. And to be able to say to our kids, what do you think about that? Why do you think people do that? And though we mock it and it's funny, for them in real life it isn't. How do you think God feels about that? And asking them questions right back like that makes them come up with an answer. I never forget my daughter when she was very young before. I told her my own history about a year before. She was already educated on one age-appropriate level about sexual themes, and she saw a lesbian. And this lesbian was very butch and mannish, a very well-known lesbian. And she saw this person in the media, and she said, why does that girl act like a boy? And I said to her, well, why do you think? Well, I don't know. She doesn't know the Lord? And I said, well, I don't know if she does or not, but she might not, and I suspect from her history she doesn't. And I know many women like this, and when they act like this, it usually means a couple of things. It usually means they were never really affirmed as women. They grew up in a home where their womanhood or femininity wasn't given a chance to develop. It wasn't nurtured. For example, in Asia, many Asian women are not lesbian, but they shave their heads, wear real short hair, and bind their breasts flat, and they dress like men because in Asian culture, they want the firstborn, where they're only allowed one child, they want the firstborn to be a male. And many of the daughters will assume that role and deny femininity. Won't be thought of as desirable by men and thus lessen the risk of potential abuse. People do things for reasons. So I think that talking about that with, you know, like my daughter, when I explained this to her, maybe in words that were simpler, but when I explained it to her, the point being, she then had understanding about people that will serve her the rest of her life. And instead of just judging them and reacting to differentness and weirdness, she will see them as people who do things for reasons, which is the foundation of compassion. Isn't that what makes God's love so wonderful? He looks beyond the things we do to see why. And And then my daughter said, well, it's still kind of weird. And I said, yeah. I said, wait till I tell you what I'm going to tell you about your daddy. Anyway, that's what I would say. We need to, the world is talking every day. The fact that we don't talk is more than just a failure. It's criminally negligent because we fail to equip our children to navigate out there and in here in a world that puts them at risk and challenges the values that we say are important. And asking questions is a good way to get them, to find out where they're at. Shall we move on? Did you have a question or did I answer it? Good. Well, there you have it. That's where it all happens. These struggles in people's lives, adultery, premarital sex, and same-sex attractions are common in pastoral care and to the human condition. Also, hungry hearts that make them emotionally driven to overattach, and adult victims of childhood sexual abuse and that baggage, people who have overfed an appetite, it controls them, and people who've never been affirmed in their gender identity and its ongoing consequence. Would you say that there's a lot of pastoral care that needs to be happening, and yet the church is famous for only offering moral boundaries, which is not the same as being able to make disciples of people who come from these histories? That's our point here. We want to make disciples. Now, getting into that. I want to share with you, I'll save this next portion till after lunch, but I will share with you this. Just use a blank piece of paper here. Turn your note page over. I forewarned you that your outline covers 12 to 18 hours of material. We're going to not fill all that in, so don't be distressed. I'm still giving you the most important material, I feel. Forgive me. I'll get this erased and then I'll make sense. Here's what I'd like you to do. Make a grid like this. You're wanting 1, 2, 3 boxes times 3. That's 9. We want to look at 9 contributing factors in the development of these problems we've just looked at. People do things for reasons. Why? Well, to have solutions, we must have an understanding as to where these things come from. And, of course, you see that I've written bio for biology and psi or psyche for psychology and then the spirit. We are body, soul, and spirit. We are biological, psychological, and supernatural beings. And unfortunately, as mentioned earlier, most Christian care only features a spiritual worldview, and that is valid but not exclusive, as we described earlier to you. So let's take a look at 9 basic factors that cause sexual problems in people. Number 1, let's take a look at the foundation of what we are, and that's genetics. Now, an issue where genes are talked about commonly as a contributor to sexual issues is that of homosexuality, the gay gene. There isn't a gay gene, at least not yet discovered. The most current research does not say there is a gay gene, and if you've heard there's a gay gene and have still believed there is a gay gene, you are mistaken and you've heard propaganda. There has been much speculation about the possibility of a genetic contributor toward homosexuality. There may yet one day be discovered a genetic link. As of yet, all the possible speculations have yielded results that are inconclusive. Now, granted, this is a dramatic, still dynamic, unfolding field of research. We don't know what they'll find out in 25 years. So the jury isn't completely rendering a verdict yet, but what has thus far been discovered is this. That even if genetics or other features of biology could be found to contribute in the development of some kinds of homosexuality, genetics or biology would not explain all forms of homosexuality, and additionally, these would only be influences that encourage the risk of this developing. They don't demand an outcome. There's no born gay, can't change gene discovered yet. At best, some homosexuals may have some degree of possible, as of yet unproven, influence that might increase the likelihood of this being developed. And what that actually means is any of you here who were straight could actually have that genetic influence in you. It just was never triggered and realized. Because that's not an automatic mandate. It's not the same as having blue eye color. That's a biologic bit, not a behavioral one. Now, having said this, genes do affect the sexual package, very obviously. And there are some people with abnormalities that affect their sexuality. For example, some men have an extra female chromosome. Instead of XY, they are XXY. This is called Klinefelter's. Klinefelter's syndrome does not make you homosexual. It does not make you feminine if you're a man. It does not make you a transsexual. It makes you sterile. You will not father children. It does affect sexual performance, and you will have to take hormones, substitutes, because your body won't produce them. I know a couple of men with this condition. They are both heterosexual. They are both married. They both have adoptive children. They both take hormone substitutes. So their nature gives you a genetic flaw, even an extra female chromosome, because nature is fallen. But that doesn't result necessarily in an identity crisis. Likewise, there are some women, instead of being XX, she's XO. That's called Turner's syndrome. Turner's means she's born without half the female chromosomal complement. This does not make her butch and mannish. Actually, women with Turner's are more feminine than the average woman. There are no cases on record of a woman with this condition being lesbian. It means she will be sterile, she will not have her monthly cycle, she will need hormone supplement. Again, sexual packaging is affected, not identity. Okay? So, that's just some genetic foundation, but of course, here is where I think there could be a trouble spot, biologically speaking, and that's in the area of hormones. Now, hormones, I'm not talking about when you go through puberty and suddenly your sexual flame is ignited. I'm talking about a much deeper problem. Now, this is what I call my shorthand for a pregnant woman. You follow that? Anyway, research has been done now, and I just read about it again in a major news magazine just very recently, that when the baby is actually much smaller than this, when the baby is in the 6th to 8th week and the 8th to 16th week, in this period of fetal development, there's a powerful sexualizing phenomenon that happens to baby called differentiation. This is important because all fetuses start out female, because both male and female fetuses share the X chromosome. This makes perfect sense that God would make Adam before Eve, because the genetic material for an Eve existed in Adam. It did not exist to make an Adam from an Eve. Are you with me? And this is reflected all the way down into the fetal development of babies now. We all start out feminine on a scale. And then, at this window in the first trimester, powerful androgens, or sexualizing chemicals, hormones, are released upon the developing fetus. These will turn the female bits into male bits and will clarify the feminine bits and make them female. And this not only is true reproductive organs speaking, it's true in the way the brain is wired, which is the more profound effect. Your brain is different if you're a female than a male's brain. Now, we all laugh at this, but in the age of feminism, where there are no distinctions and should not be any distinctions between male and females, well, the obvious truth is there are, and it's not just your private parts, it's in your brain wiring. The way the male brain is wired is distinctly different than the female brain. And this is part of the complementarity God intended. But here's the issue. This is what I'm... All that I've shared with you so far is factual. Here's what is now the theoretic part, based on the facts. At some point, if here's the masculine outcome, and here's the feminine outcome of behaviors, Haven't you heard people say, like a teacher or a Sunday school worker, gosh, Johnny's different from the other boys. The other boys want to play with cars. They're rough and tumble, want to play in the dirt. But Johnny doesn't want to get dirty, and he wants to stay in and play with the dolls and hang with the girls. And he's real verbal and nurturant, and the boys are real combative and competitive. Now, I'm talking in big stereotypes, but you've heard this kind of discussion. This behavior is called gender nonconformity. Children who experience gender nonconformity run a much higher risk of developing homosexually and transsexually. It doesn't mean that biology said they will be, but maybe biology has set them up. Here's how. If in the androgen wash of the brain in early fetal development, Johnny only gets this level when most boys fall over here in this percentile, then his behaviors may demonstrate more feminine-like. He may be more nurturant. He may be more verbal. He may demonstrate interests that are more passive, verbal, nurturant. And this does not make him a homosexual, but how people will perceive him and label him may induce the crisis that causes him to question himself. Are you with me? And what about Janie, little Janie developing? Instead of getting her androgen wash that puts her in this range, she gets it way over here because she gets a big dose. And so she is outward, competitive, combative. That doesn't mean she's a man. It doesn't mean she's a lesbian. But it means she demonstrates behaviors that are less nurturant, and they may be interpreted in culture as mannish, and she may be labeled, and thus crisis in identity is induced. Not because biology made her that way, because of how other people reacted to her. Are you with me? Now, research of some lesbians has revealed this, that in the first trimester, moms took a drug to prevent miscarriage, and that drug has interfered with brain wiring in the androgen wash phase. And this has resulted in daughters that are much more mannish, aggressive, combative, competitive, and higher incidence of lesbianism. So to say that nature never makes you gay isn't altogether something I could support. I would say that nature may not make you a homosexual in outcome, but it could, in the fallen sense, set you up to be misinterpreted. And then when people begin to label you, then you have the identity crisis. Do I make sense so far? And this is called the neuroendocrine theory. And more is being done, and they're, you know, it's getting a lot more affirmed as a potential fact. Then we have brain wiring here. That is what we call LAB, learned, acquired behavior. That is, you weren't born with it, it was cultivated. I mentioned to you earlier about your brain wiring gravitating toward pleasure. Let me give you a story in my own life that underscores the point of the way your brain operates. I was not born destined by my genetic code to smoke a cigarette. But I ended up smoking 2 packs a day for 7 years. I wasn't born with some destiny biologically compelling me to smoke. I started smoking for psychological reasons. I was an exchange student. I was living in Brazil. And growing up feeling insecure already, coming from a damaged history, alcoholic mom, her lover sexually violating me, my mother being killed, being separated from my father, growing up being taunted and tormented. You can understand I had just a few issues, and if teenagers normally are insecure, how much more heightened was my own? So my desire to fit in a foreign culture was all the more exaggerated. And because my host brother ran with the cool hip crowd, he smoked, they smoked, I smoked. I would have turned purple if it would have made me acceptable. And I turned purple. I turned blue, green, and white when I started to suck that toxin into my lungs. I wasn't naturally born with the capacity to smoke. My psychologic drive insisted. So I knew intellectually and morally smoking was not a good thing because it damages the body. I wasn't ignorant. That didn't matter. What mattered was being acceptable. So I started smoking, and I did choke and cough and hack, but eventually my body stopped protesting. And then I had a psychological crutch. But then it moved beyond just psychology. My body became addicted to the nicotine. Now, then years pass. I finally become a Christian. And I only found the victory over smoking when I finally told God the truth. God did not wave a magic wand and take away my appetite for cigarettes. I had to crucify it daily. And I only found victory when I told God the truth. I love this stuff, and I don't want to quit. I don't care if it hurts me. I love smoking. I love it socially. I love it personally. And even if it damages my body, I still love it. Now, that's the truth, isn't it? People get all pious. Oh, I'm a Christian and I don't want to smoke now. And the fact is, yes, you do. But what will you do in light of how you feel? So I could say, God, I want it, but help me quit. And God daily gave me grace to crucify my flesh. And I chewed my fingernails off. And I ate candy like I shouldn't have. And I chewed more gum than the industry could produce. But finally, I even dreamed about smoking, you know. I would be naked in a church with a cigarette. Now, I don't want a Freudian interpretation of that. But anyway, what happened was, finally, even the dreams stopped. It was as if the dreams were like a reflection of my appetite. Since I wouldn't feed it in the outside world when my subconscious was alive and prowling without boundaries in my dreamland, my subconscious would go digging into the filing cabinet of memory to pull out an experience of smoking in an attempt to feed an appetite that was being starved outwardly. And finally, the appetite starved out and the dreams stopped. And you know what? Now, years later, I don't look at a smoker and secretly wish I could have one. And whenever I'm around people smoking, I don't have an internal impulse that wishes it could have it. I did for a while, but not now. The point is, my brain learned and acquired through repetition the ability to smoke. And then my brain learned to crucify the pattern and build new patterns in its place. Now, this is very similar in parallel to the more complex and more difficult issue of overcoming my homosexual history. I tell people that I will never live as if my history never happened. I'm not here to say Jesus does magic and takes it away like it never was. That is a misrepresentation of salvation. Jesus takes away your guilt, not your memory, and not your history. And so I cultivated, like learning a language, I cultivated homosexual appetite permanently etched in my brain. I will never forget that I experienced those things and that they brought me pleasure. But they have receded into the great background that even around homosexual people, there's no inner, oh, I wish I could have that. But for a while, there was. I was not born gay, I believe. I believe that the factors I mentioned to you shaped me toward vulnerability. And then as a teenager, already being sexually defiled and knowledgeable, already feeling hungry for masculine love, missing my father and peer group connection, I got involved in homosexual events. At first, like with smoking, these physical events were sometimes repulsive to me initially, or unpleasant, and even morally, an alarm bell went off. Stop it. What are you doing? But my overarching psychological hunger to be loved and to find intimacy, even out of a garbage can, was better than no love at all. And so I overruled my initial protests, and then that which I later began to enjoy became dominant and controlling as I was propelled along by it. Do I make sense? Then I get saved. God doesn't just wipe it out. I had to daily crucify the appetite I used to feed. I had to make hard, difficult decisions with myself when I wanted to give in. I had to say no to things I used to say yes to. God gave me the grace to do it, but He didn't take away the appetite for my convenience. Does that make sense? I love them. They're always so different. So, today, I live a life beyond homosexuality, and not only have I crucified that appetite from controlling me, if on occasion it might surface, I know how to deal with it and manage it like batting a fly out of my way. It's not a big struggle, arm wrestling, who will win kind of battle like it was in the beginning. Add to it, I have acquired the ability to enjoy sex with my wife, and because that's the appetite that I cultivate, that's the dominant pattern in appetite that is the more compelling and desirable feature for me. Are you with me? That's possible because the brain has the ability to learn and acquire behaviors. And it's very interesting. In pro-gay propaganda, They'll always say, oh, sexuality is very fluid. That's why heterosexuals who play around with homosexuality, they can enjoy it. Everybody's really bisexual, and everybody can really enjoy homosexuality, and that's why straight men, they go into homosexuality, and they can enjoy it because sexuality is fluid. But when you say gay people can live beyond homosexuality, oh, no, it's concrete, absolute, inflexible. No fluidity at all. Once gay, always gay. And that's nothing more than political propaganda. Research reveals, according to clinicians, that homosexuals who are motivated, who are highly motivated, can have a recovery rate higher than for drug addicts and alcoholics. And just in yesterday's Dominion, I cut the article out, in which research revealed, according to one study in New Orleans, United States, just recently, that people who are highly motivated with support are able to overcome homosexual orientation. It may not be like they have amnesia as if they had never been gay. It is that they learn and acquire the ability to move beyond. Are you with me? And that's true, actually, for all of us. Now then, in this next column, the psychological column. Basically, genetics give us the foundation of our sex package. Hormones affect life perceptions and give you sexual appetite. And brain wiring shapes you in, you know, the way the choices that you make feed into the actual shaping of your brain. Your choices and life experiences affect brain wiring. Then, in the psychological column, all of us come from what I call the setting. That is the environment you grow up in. What does that include? Your family of origin. Good or bad, healthy or destructive, abusive or nurturant, everybody comes from a family of origin. Even if they abandoned you at birth, that was still a family that abandoned you. Everybody comes from a family of origin. Then, in addition to that, in modern Western culture, we have powerful influences from peer group. Is that right? Research of teenagers reveals that many times they get involved in sex before marriage. Teenagers do not say, oh, my hormones drove me to it. I couldn't help myself. They say, isn't that what everybody else is doing in my peer group? And that's what my girlfriends are doing, so I don't want to be left out. If that's what my girlfriends are doing with their boyfriends, or that's what my boyfriend expects. Or the boys think, well, that's what the other guys do to prove they're men. I guess I'd better do it too. In so many words, that's what modern magazines print in just the last 2 months. I've got collections of these articles talking about interviews with teenagers who make these kinds of statements. Now see, peer grouping is unfortunate in that we assume peer grouping is normal. It's very, very brief. Most children throughout history have not been raised in peer grouping settings. Peer grouping is a consequence of the public education system, which is the consequence of poverty during the Industrial Revolution. And in the Industrial Revolution, children in the cities had to be cared for while parents were away working in factories. And the parents divested their parenting of the children in educating them to the public system, which took them in. We assume this is normal, desirable, and preferable. When you will hear parents say, because my daughter, for example, well, she has been in school, both an international school and a New Zealand school. Right now, my daughter is in an online school program in Los Angeles. She goes to work with her laptop. She has 5 teachers, and she daily submits her work, and she goes to school via the Internet. But for many years, because of our travel schedule, my wife, who is an educator by profession, she would provide homeschooling or tutoring on the road with my daughter. And my daughter also would be homeschooled with several other students, so she was never alone. But people would always say, their first concern is, oh, your daughter's being homeschooled. What about her important interaction with the peer group? And I would say, please don't overestimate that. It's part of the contributive problem in culture. You see, values that you find important will only be transmitted over time through the strength of relationship tie. And our modern system works against that. Parents are enormously disadvantaged today because your child, from the time they are 3 or 4 or 5, go into an institution to be cared for 7 hours a day. They spend more time with people, their peers, than with anybody else for about 15 years. That's who they bond with. And that's why when mommy and daddy say, my Christian values say, Janie, don't wear your top so low, Janie doesn't care what you think. She cares what her peer group thinks. Because there's where the value system has been reinforced through time in quality of relationship. And then, where does the peer group get their values formed? Who do kids spend the most time with after the peer group? The television and other forms of pop culture. Children spend 11,000 hours watching TV, not even just listening to music, just listening to TV 11,000 hours by the time they're 15, 16. Parents spend an average of 3 minutes a day, or fathers 3 minutes a week speaking into the lives of their children. There is no way that that will ever compete or compensate for the powerful wave of pop culture continually reinforced by the peer group. Do you follow me? And when parents intuit, as they rightly do, that my child is being swept away by culture, now you know exactly why. We've devised a mechanism that puts our children at greater risk. And maybe we can't take all of our children out of public school and homeschool them. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that many times we don't even attempt to recognize and therefore compensate our children by spending more time. Many of us are trying to pay off bills. We're caught up in financial circumstances where we may not have much choice. And even then, we could at least pray that God would intervene and bring into our children's lives compensation if we can't fully. Are you with me? Because kids hanging with other kids, they're hanging with people who don't know more than they do. And the only people they listen to as their advisors are not the teachers who change from year after year. And isn't it true, haven't you noticed with kids, that by the time they're teenagers, it's not a, oh, look, a wonderful new mentor for me. It's them versus us. And so then, you know, the kids go through this experience and their values are shaped by the people they do bond with, their peer group, and the peer group is influenced by the media. Don't we see it? So you can't underestimate this. Peer group influence, uh-huh. Assume it's... That's right. And there's nothing wrong with having relationship within our generation, but that's not how the real world works. That's not how it works at the employment office, at a job. You know, you've got to learn to relate to older and younger people. It's not how it really works in a family that has more than three, you know, that has more than one child. You've got kids older and younger. And it's not how it works in the community or in a church. We all have to relate to people beyond our peer group. And we can enjoy rewarding, satisfying, useful, mentoring, and serving-oriented relationships when we move beyond our peer group. So just because our culture, which is 10 minutes long in light of the last 1,000 years, just because our culture assumes this is the way doesn't mean it's the best way or the only way. And the negative thing about peer grouping is, as we see even in Christian kids, is that they spend more time bonding with kids who get their values out of church than with people who have values that would help them. And so even though we give them the right cognitive theology and morality boundaries, it's like, bing, it doesn't matter. They've been saturated, steeped and soaked in these values over years that everything else pales in comparison. They don't even consciously know what's going on. And so I'm not saying, again, we can take all of our kids out of public school, but many times we don't try to help our children navigate. We don't aware the mechanism that puts them at greater risk, and thus we can't compensate them, and thus they are at greater risk. Mm-hmm. That's right. And that's a recent development, and there's also some unhealth at the far end. You know, in Singapore where I live, they would not allow the baby boom generation of high education and wealth now in Singapore to just shuttle off somewhere their aging parents, like you would see in the American model. They made it so that aging parents had the power to sue their children for welfare care. Because it's not the state's job to care for aging parents. This is blood family, for God's sake, was their opinion. And you will be responsible. They took care of you. You take care of them now. And they were building many of the even public homes that a lot of the population in Singapore lives in, with granny flats, so that aging parents could literally physically be accommodated by the family. Because the government was sending a signal to the community, it's not our job to care for these people. It's your family. You care for them. And the fact that this sounds bizarre to us is, you know, tells you how far we've drifted from the idea of community. Our attitude is, oh, please don't inconvenience me, anybody. I've got my own agenda. Everybody support that, you know, instead of caring in relationship and in community. Because that's the other end of the spectrum, is caring for the aging people who also belong to our community. Isn't that right? Then we also have, of course, society, and society creates culture. And culture has its values. Again, using Singapore, if I may, as an illustration, my daughter moved away from Babylon, I mean America, when she was five. And she has lived most of her life and her formative years in Singapore. Now, beyond mommy and daddy, beyond the extended family, beyond the friends and peer grouping that she involved herself with, which influence her, the greater culture she breathed and lived in also affected her worldview of sexuality, among other things. And in Singapore, to be a virgin is still highly esteemed. In Singapore, moral values are highly esteemed, and the greatest Asian value of them all is self-control. In the West, however, being a virgin is looked down upon as prudish and that you're really missing out, and that self-control is a bad thing. It's restraint and repression, which is a bad thing in Western culture, where we live to satisfy every whim and appetite and scratch every itch, essentially. Isn't that right? And all of our advertising is aimed at this. Don't miss out. You can have it too. Don't restrain yourself. Indulge. You know, this is the way our world operates in the West. And my daughter growing up in a culture that was like that, it was a jarring revelation for her to come back to Western society, where the first week in school, she has to learn to navigate around gangs, drug availability, and sexual pressure. Oh, yeah, and also find a meaningful education. It was a revelation for her how different the culture was that way. Again, we assume this is normal. No, it isn't. Not everywhere. In much of Western society, this is typical. But it doesn't mean that it's the only way in much of the world. And so the culture and its values. In Singapore, there is no pornography allowed. You try to smuggle it in, it is a $50,000 fine. You try to download it from the internet, they will find you. They've already arrested people for downloading, and it's a $10,000 fine. Their attitude is pornography is not a right. It affects people, and even if, say, 99% of you could look at pornography and it would not encourage criminal behavior, if only one person out of 100 is encouraged toward criminal behavior, voyeurism, exhibitionism, molestation, rape, that's 1% too many. So the rest of you who can cope with it are denied it for the sake of the weaker, and that's a biblical principle. But see, in the West, any restraint is worse than the consequences of pornography. Because that's censorship, and God knows we can't be censored. No, we can't have boundaries. That's bad. And so we have the consequences in Western culture, where 1 out of every 8 women will be raped, 1 out of 4 girls molested, 1 out of 6 boys molested. I'd say that's some pretty big consequence, wouldn't you? And that may not be all fueled by pornography, but I would say almost all people who have sexual problems and crimes in their lives have pornography as an overarching element, feeding an appetite, expanding it beyond the boundaries. Okay? Then, in addition to the setting that influences us, this is what people do to us. But this isn't the big deal. Here's the big deal. It's your personality. It's your temperament. In other words, it's your perceptions. Your reactions. Let me say it another way. It's not what people do to you that will affect you nearly as much as how you perceive it and react. This is where Christian counseling and the ministry of the Holy Spirit have their center of the target. Right here. Right here. This is the problem. It's not that Uncle molested you that's created the problem as much as your reaction to Uncle molesting you that's crippled life. Are you with me? Child A and Child B grow up in the same setting. Same home, same town, same extended family, same school. Child A and Child B have the same daddy. Child A, however, says, Daddy travels a lot on business and I miss Daddy. But I know Daddy loves me, and when Daddy comes home, I will enjoy being with him. But that's very different than Child B, who says, Daddy travels a lot on business. Daddy's always away. Obviously, he loves being away more than being here. And he loves his work more than me, so when Daddy tries to come home and love me, I'm going to reject him and show him how it feels. Same daddy, same situation, different reaction based on a different perception due to different temperament and personality. As every parent with more than one kid knows, Child A is completely different from Child B. Isn't that right? So, when Uncle molested you, of course that would hurt you wound you and possibly deeply enrage you. That's typically understandable and human in reaction. But it's not that uncle damaged you only, it's how you reacted that may be the crippling feature that often isn't seen by the victim. Because like a fish in the water doesn't know it's wet, victims don't often understand. They blame the one who hurt them. They don't understand how they reacted, maybe half the problem. Are you with me? And this is where the revelation has to happen from the Holy Spirit. It's not that he hurt you. It's your own bitter and twisted, toxic, untrusting reaction that's really done the crippling. Your reaction may be perfectly understandable and human in light of what happened, but it's still hurting you and hindering you. Is that right? Then, there are specific events. And here's how I would list them. Being starved for love that is not nourished. And then being damaged through abuse. And then experimentation. Again, let me give you these statistics. "80% of my clients with sexual problems, gay or straight, they have histories of sexual violation before the age of 12. So down here we have the specific events that do happen to us to shape us. We grow up in a general setting, family, peer group, and culture. We react with that based on temperament and personality. But then there are specific things that do happen to affect our hearts and our lives. 80% of my clients have been damaged through sexual abuse. 40% were physically abused apart from sexual abuse. 70% have histories of being verbally damaged through labeling, a fancy term when you call people fat, dumb, stupid, ugly, useless, worthless, mistake, reject, not wanted, gay, queer, failure. Those are labels that hurt people. And most of my clients have a history of at least 5 years of that kind of labeling in their formative teenage years. Indeed, words have the power of life and death. That's why God says he will judge us for the things that we say to and about people. Words shape destinies. What did C.S. Lewis say? We're all either helping people toward God or away from him. And then, that's the damage part. Then, many of my clients have also been starved. 90% report not having relationship attachments. And sex became the best substitute. Doesn't make it right, makes it understandable. In fact, if I can do this, you got three appetites. We know this. We're about to satisfy one of them in a little while. Food for the body. You eat or you suffer and then you die. There's no option, is there? And then for the mind or the intellect, we hunger for truth. That's why a child's first word is mommy or daddy. Second word is generally no. Third word is generally mine. And fourth word is why. We are born with an appetite to know the truth. Why do we take rocket rides to the moon or sail in little wooden boats 500 years ago across the uncharted sea? Because we want to know why. How do traffic lights work? I don't know. Why? All kinds of questions people have. And this means you either satisfy the appetite by providing answers, or children will simply take their appetite and get it satisfied elsewhere. Is that right? Now, along with this appetite for truth, you can see why God would make it this way. Because many people come to know the Lord Jesus, even though they would never go to church or read the Bible. But they love the world of science, physics, biology, and they study truth. And all truth belongs to God. And that's why many people end up getting saved, though they would never read a Bible or go to church, because truth ultimately ends at God's doorstep. There are many Christian scientists today. I've met some of them. Dr. Dwayne Geish, three-time Nobel Prize-winning biologist, who, he came to know the Lord through his love of science in the world that God made. That brought him to the door of God. He wasn't looking in the traditional religious approach, and he heads up a group of about 800 scientists who found God under similar circumstances. What's that famous quote? I can't think of the author, but he's a very, very well-known man. And he said, you throw a little bit of truth at a person, and they'll fall out of their faith. You throw a lot of truth at a person, and they'll find it again. And that's the way it is. So a lot of people come to know the Lord because even though the Bible is the truth, It doesn't tell me everything that is true. It doesn't tell me the diameter of the moon, its distance from the earth, and its impact on the tides. The Bible doesn't tell me about Bernoulli's principle of aerodynamic lift and what makes a heavy metal airplane fly when it weighs 1,000,000 pounds. But these things are yet true. It doesn't tell me how to set a broken bone or do open heart surgery or drive a car or how an elevator works. But these are all built upon truths that if I know them, my life is benefited. Is that right? So, truth for the mind, and then for the body, heart or the soul, of course, it's relationships that provide love. We'll talk about that later. The point is, each of these appetites, of course, can be counterfeited. For example, junk food for the body. Have you thought of it? How clever of human beings to create food that isn't food. It may taste like food. It may be advertised as food. It may promise to do things that food does. For example, soda. In the industry, they call it liquid candy. That's because it has enormous amounts of sugar. And by its actual chemical composition, it does nothing to satisfy your body's need for fluid. There is nothing in it that will make your thirst go away. It feels like water. It feels like it is satisfying thirst. But actually, by engineering, it can't, by chemical composition, satisfy any of your body's requirement for not only fluid, it actually works against your body's requirement for fluid. So while you drink it, you are actually being depleted. And then, junk food. You know, there's probably nothing wrong with the occasional candy bar, nothing wrong with the occasional batch of fries, but if you only live on those things, oh, it may make the appetite for hunger go away. It may promise to do what food does. It may smell good. It may taste good. It may make the empty craving stop, but it cannot do the one thing food must. It doesn't nourish you. The snack food industry is built upon an assumption. You are already well nourished enough that you can afford empty calories and that you are wealthy enough to spend your money on empty calories just to tickle your palate or knock off the edge of hunger. But you should already be better nourished apart from this. So here you can eat, and while you eat, you can starve. Isn't that like sin? It promises to satisfy, and it does, in just about everything, but it misses the point. In fact, it's like the junk food for the mind. What are some of the, the ideologies which promise enlightenment, the truer insights and the esoteric knowledge? Oh, there's lots of truth out there. The problem is, these other philosophies, other religions, other ideologies, they promise enlightenment and partially offer the idea that you've learned things, but they don't do the one thing that truth is supposed to do, connect you to God in a relationship. That's the point. It ultimately brings you to God. And many of those truths fill up the appetite to know, but they don't take you to God's doorstep. They may take you very much away. Is that right? And there's where sexual immorality for the soul is like a junk food. I love underscoring like that. Thank you, Lord. Junk food for the soul, that is. When I was in a lover's embrace, it made me feel wanted and loved. It might not have been the best or moral means to get it, but it did satisfy me, or there would have been no power and attraction in it. When somebody wanted me sexually, it made the loneliness go away. It filled up that appetite to feel wanted and needed and valued. And so sexual sin has satisfaction, or people wouldn't be trapped by it like they are, or go looking for it though they know it's wrong. It meets the hunger, or people wouldn't be vulnerable. But it doesn't meet the need in right boundary and right relationship priority. And so you can have lots of sex, but you can starve to death. For while it satisfies, it doesn't nourish. Because sex is not the vehicle to get your soul nourished. Sex is only good when your soul is already nourished. Do I make sense? Sex is not God's vehicle to get love. And when you use it as the means to get love, you starve no matter how much of it you partake. It's when you already know what love is, sex takes on its rightful place. And this is not what is understood by millions of emotionally starved people. They think if I can find the right person, or I have enough sex, or I get the right sex, then I will feel wanted and valued. But it's the mistake that they make. It's not the means to the end. Do I make sense with that? You don't have to agree with me. That's my view. And you have to do your own seminar. Now, with this in mind, many of my clients are starving, many of them have been damaged, and Those who have not been starved and not been damaged can still have big sexual problems for just one simple reason. You don't have to come from a history of abuse and deprivation. You don't have to be damaged growing up and abused to suffer sexual problems if you simply got involved in experimentation. How many men have I talked with? They didn't come from tragic histories like mine. They started looking at pornography when they were teenagers. Nobody made them do it. They brought it on themselves, unwitting, but they did. And they may wrestle today very, very much. Not because they got abused or they weren't loved. Because they did things they weren't supposed to. They crossed the lines and didn't understand that it would come back later to get them. Does that make sense? That's why Satan wants you to be as experienced as possible. Isn't that the pressure on our young people? To be as experienced as possible and from every corner of our culture which is under Satan's lordship. Isn't he called the prince of this world? In every quarter of our culture, you can't turn on the television, you can't drive down the road without seeing the billboard, you can't look at a magazine shop without having it rubbed in your face constantly, this issue of sensuality and decadence. You to know, which now you have learned, you will never unlearn. You will have to manage. Okay, now, finally here before our break, as he flips the tape... Okay. It's not enough that we have biology and psychological vulnerabilities that interplay together. But wait, there's more. We also happen to live in this reality. We are spiritual creatures. And what's your first spiritual truth? You're fallen. Now let me make a point here with this. The fallen nature is grossly underestimated in many Christian circles. Now, I am Pentecostal charismatic, but in many churches they are very victory-oriented, very triumphalistic. And the attitude is, once you're born again, these things are resolved, and that is not the truth. What is resolved is that your sin is covered, your guilt is removed, and you can enjoy a relationship with God, who now begins to affect your life. And... how fallen are you? Well, the fact is that even though everybody in this room who is born again and spirit-filled, who loves God and is a child of the kingdom, will grow old, get sick, and die. Is that right? Because the curse still has its effect upon us. Is that right? So the curse affects us in various ways. And two big ways that we struggle with our fallen nature is immaturity and insecurity, which we will take a look at later. Immaturity and insecurity. And so... I guess the point here is, it is my opinion you will never be so whole, so free, so filled, so illumined, so enlightened, that you will outgrow this reality. In fact, it will kill you, and it will give you a fit along the way. Here's how the fallen creature lives by faith. When I sin, I have a high priest that I can turn to confidently, who has been acquainted with my humanity. Though I ought not to be making wrong choices, the fact is my fallen nature makes me vulnerable. And so when I do sin, I can go to my high priest and he will cleanse me from all unrighteousness. Is that right? And then when sin finally kills me because I get to live long enough to grow old and die, then death is not the final outcome. I will be resurrected. And when I am resurrected, I will not be cursed and separated from God. I'm under the new covenant in Christ. Therefore, I am reconciled to the Father and will enter in through blessing of relationship with Him forever. Is that right? That's how fallen people live by faith. Faith doesn't say you will never wrestle. It's when you do, here's how you manage it. We'll talk more about that later. This is not taught commonly to people anymore. That's right. It's the foundation of the way the human being is on the spirit level. So while we may grow and make progress and learn to manage our weaknesses better, we will always have them because we are still fallen in this life who must live by faith, banking on God's character, that what He said is true. My sins can be covered, I can be resurrected, and I am reconciled. And that's how the fallen creature lives by faith. Is that true? Then, but wait, there's still more. There's Satan. And Satan does three basic things to us. He is able to tempt. And temptation simply means Satan's way to get you to meet your needs the wrong way. Temptation is Satan's way of getting you to meet your needs wrongly. You want to be loved? Everybody does. You didn't get it growing up? Satan will see to it that you're compensated. And the compensation will be satisfying, and it will trap you. And then Satan is able to not only tempt you, he's able to deceive you. Now, I've had some Christians say to me, oh no, I'm a believer now and I've got the Word and I've got the Spirit. And I've had to say to them, excuse me. Excuse me. Adam and Eve, they knew no sin, did they? Adam and Eve had a perfect face-to-face relationship with God we can only imagine. They did not live by faith, they lived by fact. Concrete reality. They knew God in a way we don't. Secondly, they had no sin. No greed, no fear, no insecurity, no psychological imbalance. They could tune into God, they could see God, they could experience God. They had no sin. And Adam and Eve had perfect intellect. We use about 10%, they used it all. They were unfallen creatures. And so they had enormous advantage we cannot imagine. But you know what? They were still capable of sinning. And they did it because they were deceived. Satan did not say, worship me, not God. Instead, Satan said, what? Did God really say, don't eat the fruit of the tree that would open your eyes and make you like God? And if God says he's so good, but he would deny you something good, then maybe God isn't as good as he said. In so many words, that's what Satan did. Satan is named Satan in Hebrew because in Hebrew, Satan means accuser. And who does Satan accuse? The character of God to us. Because if you believe God is not good, if you believe God does not care about your deepest needs, if you believe God doesn't have your best interest at heart, then that means you will have to go somewhere else to meet your needs and take care of yourself. Would you agree? Yeah, you'd say anything to have a break, I know. Here's the point. Whenever I see a pastor run off with the church secretary, and he says, you know, my wife and I just didn't have a good relationship anymore, but yet... this secretary of mine, we began to minister together and the anointing of God was with us and we built this relationship bridge with each other and, you know, God could have told us he doesn't want it and here God anointed us and used us and is it always wrong to commit adultery? Did God really say? They're asking a question somebody else asked in a garden a long time ago. Did God really say? Well, yeah, God really said adultery is always wrong. He doesn't care under what circumstances or how satisfying it may be. It may be absolutely understandably satisfying. It is still a violation of God's intent for the boundaries that are set in a marriage. Is that true? When God is a moralist, it is not because he is a moralist only. Moral boundaries are about protecting people's hearts and lives. God doesn't have rules for the sake of rules. They're about protecting people. And so whenever a denomination or a church has a gay couple come in and they say we love each other and we've got a relationship built upon mutuality and justice and integrity, we are not promiscuous, and did God really say homosexuality is out of the boundaries? That they have to ask the question, it may be worth that we consider from critical thinking skills what it is we believe and why, to be sure. We don't need to be dumb sheep who say, well, because God said. There may be truth in that, but we need to know why God says what he says, because God is logical and intelligent and rational. So if God says no to something, there are reasons why. You can bank on it. And they are psychological, biological, and spiritual reasons why. And so, yeah, God really said, he's not vague on this issue of homosexuality, like some try to muddy the waters and make it to be. God is very straightforward. The fact that we have to ask the question to justify what we want is the concern that makes me hear that echo from the garden. Did God really say? And then, Satan is able to infect. Again, the Bible does not use the words possess or oppress. The Bible uses the word demonize. And it involves the concept like biological infection. Some infections around a splinter are localized, and some infections are systemic. That is totally through the body. True? Now, if you're a Christian here, and you've got God living in you, can you still get the flu virus? Then get a clue. You can be demonically infected, too. Don't you tell me you can't. You don't have to believe me. But my opinion is, yes, you can be infected. And God gives us an analogy from the body that speaks about the soul. Because God says He gives us illustrations in the physical world which reflect truths about the invisible but very real world around us. Correct? A pastor came to me demonized one time. He did not grow up in a home where he was violated and abused. He came from a pretty reasonable background that was pretty normal, but he said he had been on a ministry trip. He had been working really hard prior to that and was worn down emotionally and physically. And in a weak moment, while he was at a hotel without accountability, he turned on the porno channel and he got a good saturating dose of pornographic material. That would be no different than if somebody with a bad case of tuberculosis came up and coughed in your face. Chances are you would risk exposure. Is that right? He got bam. And you know what? Like those microbes, alien hostile life forces looking for an opening in a host where if they are able to get a beachhead established, if they are not challenged and taken captive, they will work to take the host captive. Isn't that how viruses, germs, microbes, bacteria work when you are infected? And when you get infected with the flu, you don't quite know the day that you got it. You don't know when those invisible forces gained access to the system. But the way your immune system works is they recognize what should not be there. That is your body's guard cells. In every drop of blood, you've got about 7,000 warrior cells. And those warrior cells instantly smell throughout the entire body all at one time. Science doesn't know how. They instantly smell throughout your entire body. Something is here that should not be here. And they immediately deploy warriors to the area of invasion to take captive and then neutralize the invader. But if your body doesn't recognize the invader, if the invader is scheming and pretends to need to be there, then the body doesn't recognize it and loses its authority over the invader, and the invader begins to set up a factory of mass production of more just like it, and they set up a colony of influence. When Jesus encountered the demonized man, and he said, "What is your name?" And he said, "My name is Legion, for we are many." He could have just as easily used the word, "My name is Colony. This man has been infected and overwhelmed with a colonization." Do you follow me? That's the biologic model. And so, this pastor, he remembers the day he got exposed to the germs like seeds planted in the garden of his mind. Seeds don't seem to do much when they're first planted, but he did not take them captive and eradicate the weeds as they grew up. He would cultivate them because they brought him pleasure in secret. Consequently, he had a forest that crowded out the light eventually, and his life went from the occasional passing impure thought to a daily battle with impurity and compulsive masturbation, and he feared he was going to lose control. That's at the point he came to me. Now, when he came to me, he had been praying his brains out for months for God to take this away, and God did not. He wasn't practicing what the Bible said in Proverbs 28. Proverbs 28 says, "If you cover up your sins, you'll prosper for a while, but not in the end. But if you will confess them and renounce your sins, then you will obtain mercy, release, freedom." James 5:16 says, "We confess our sins to one another and we pray for each other that we may be healed." Most of us don't need physical healing all the time, but chronically we wrestle in an attempt to keep moral equilibrium and balance in a world that slimes us. Is that true? And so, this pastor, he concealed it. Now, you know, if I can use the infection model again, if I've got a tiny little infection here around a splinter, I can go to my medicine cabinet in my bathroom. And I don't have to go to the emergency room at the hospital. And I can do a little self-maintenance. And I can go to that medicine cabinet and I can open up the cabinet, get the hydrogen peroxide or alcohol. I can remove the splinter and kill the localized infection. No problem. Sometimes you get infected in the world you live in, and a little bit of private daily maintenance will take care of it. True? But you know what? If I have a severe case of strep throat, all the wishful thinking, mouthwash and gargle in the privacy of my bathroom won't kill it. My immune system has been so compromised that I may now need to step outside the bathroom and go get assistance from a doctor who will give me antibiotic to give my body the edge again. True? I can't think of a better model than what these scriptures are saying. In the daily world we live in, we get slimed from time to time, and a little bit of daily maintenance will take care of it. Oh, Lord, look at what I've been thinking. that's really pretty defiling and dark. I love it, but I love you more. Please cleanse me and forgive me and cover that with the blood of Jesus. And I've killed the potential infection with just a little daily maintenance in the privacy of the prayer closet when I'm honest with God. But if I cultivate that and I let it get a real deep stronghold established or a foothold established, then I can pray all I want and my authority, like a compromised immune system, my authority over it becomes compromised and I can't kill it. And so I battle it. And that's why I must go and confess it then, that somebody else can pour their authority on top of it like an antibiotic. When that pastor came to me, it wasn't me. He could have gone to his grandmother. But the point is, coming to someone else, taking off the mask, bringing that fungal infection into the light like light kills a fungus, as I began to pray for him, the power of my prayer and my authority killed what he had lost authority over. Does that make sense? And that is about demonic infection. Okay? Finally, before our lunch break, finally, there is a finally. I give you two or three of them before I finally finish. Finally, there is compromised cover. This is where we get things like generational sin and soul ties. See, when you give yourself, this is the last point is soul ties, forgive me. When you give yourself sexually to another person, you create a bond with them. In fact, we have lots of bonds in different ways that are non-sexual. I have a soul tie to my wife, and I should. Soul tie doesn't always mean bad, like we tend to equate. I should have a soul tie to my wife. We are one flesh. I have sexual union with her. Of course I have a soul tie to her. That's how we can sense things intuitively. In fact, research of people who are faithful in marriage and who were virgin before marriage show that even physically they have a higher functioning shared immune system. It's amazing. But the point is, I have a soul tie to my daughter, and I should have a soul tie to my daughter, but I do not have a sexual soul tie to her. I am bonded to her. Twins have a soul tie that's infamous or famous and studied and proven. They can't quite explain it. But it exists beyond physical connection. Isn't that true? And yet some soul ties aren't supposed to be happening. I was not supposed to have soul ties to men. I wasn't supposed to give my body to them. And thus, I have to deal with baggage and history and memory because there are connections that I've had to submit to the Lordship of Christ that were troublesome until I did. And I'll talk about what we can do about that later. Likewise, generational sin does not just mean a mystical demon, a familiar family spirit. It can. My mother had dark eyes. I had dark eyes. My daughter has dark eyes. She had dark hair. I have dark hair. My daughter has dark hair. She had olive skin. I have olive skin. My daughter has olive skin. She was a communicator, illustrator, musician. I am a communicator, illustrator, musician. And my daughter reflects these talents as well in her life. But my mother became immoral and boundaryless. I became immoral and boundaryless. And I will have you know I am doing everything in my parenting skill to see to it that the generational sin doesn't make it one more loop. Because just like eye color and certain traits can be passed down genetically, therefore we could conclude that certain family weaknesses and the propensities can be transmitted. We can't maybe empirically prove it scientifically, but we can observe it. Indeed, Jan Frank and her work with sexual abuse women, when those women were abused as little girls, 75% of them came from mothers who had been sexually violated as children as well. I'd call that a pretty big illustration of this point, wouldn't you? Some kind of boundary got violated, and without attention, it rains down like a torn umbrella onto people underneath that. Likewise, generational sin doesn't have to be a demon. It can be bad role modeling. For example, research has been revealed of people who come from alcoholic homes, either there is no role model on how to handle that popular available drug. You know, teetotaling parents, I can understand why you may choose not to drink. I'm not being critical of it. But you still must educate your children. You just can't say, well, we don't drink because we're Christians. It's not good enough. If you don't drink as a Christian, why would that be when many Christians around the world do drink, though they are Christians, and feel absolutely right with God about it? The point is, if you don't drink, there's really only a few reasons why. You don't want to give money to the liquor industry, because the liquor industry may not care about people, they care about profits. Or you choose not to because of moral reasons, you feel that God does not want you to do it, even if that's not everybody else's conviction, it's yours. And why would God not want you to do it? Because when you drink, you may lose control. Isn't that right? So many alcoholics come from homes where there was never an illustration of how to handle alcohol responsibly, or they come from homes where alcohol was abused and misused in front of them, so that when they're angry or when they're lonely, they get drunk. And that's the model they've learned. Research reveals that when you come from a home like that, your risks of becoming alcoholic are elevated. Likewise, if you grew up in a home where mommy got beaten up in front of you and you're a daughter, even though you may have hated your father and you may not trust men and may fear marrying a man who is abusive, research reveals that many women who come from abusive homes, they end up marrying an abuser. Not because they like it, but because that's the familiar pattern they've been imprinted with and they repeat it. That's a generational sin. The sins of the fathers visited upon the next generation. If you're a son and you grow up in a home where you saw your mother beaten by daddy, you may have hated your father for it, but the statistical, scientific risk is you are at greater risk of repeating that very same pattern when you're angry of hitting your wife. That's a generational sin, not due to a demon, but due to bad role modeling. That's why the way you live your life is the loudest sermon you preach. That's why. Does this make sense when you look at it? Here we are. We've got a genetic foundation that makes us sexual. We've got hormones that trigger everything from perception to sexual appetite, combined with a brain that gravitates toward pleasure and can be habituated, made habit-based. Likewise, we grow up in an environment that may be damaging and may starve us. Those can be specific events that happen to harm us, but even bigger is the way that we react, because we interpret those things based on our temperament and personality. Then on top of it, we're fallen creatures prone to immaturity and insecurity. That makes us vulnerable to impurity, combined with Satan, who knows how to exploit us very successfully, combined with the fact that even generations before us can heighten vulnerability because of their wrong choices, which reflect and echo down upon us. Now, when I put it all together, how could you not have just a few little struggles? That's why I find it amazing when Christian people think, I'm such a terrible person because I struggle with my sexuality. And I want to say to them, you too? You're not a terrible person. How could you really escape? None of us have been untouched by these things. But many of us have not known how to become discipled to grow beyond these things. We can know it's not right. That doesn't make us fix it. There are solutions to every single one. There are redemptive principles to every single one of these points. And that's the goal here. We want to disciple men and women into the sons and daughters God intended. And redemptive principles can become guidelines that help that to be achieved. We'll take a look at looking at God's intent and how we can achieve it and what those redemptive principles are when we come back from lunch. So even though it's going to be a hard slog this afternoon through all of this material, even though you are hot and will be tired, again, let's try to persevere. Try not to black out. Don't overeat. Eat healthy, eat light, eat quick, and we will reconvene here at 2. Let's reconvene at 2 o'clock, as close to the mark as we can, and then we will press through our 3.5 more hours of torture. Are you finding this useful so far? Now listen, let me tell you why I belabor these points, because I realize some of you here, you may not have big concerns directly related to these things. But you know, for understanding those we serve, and even for those who are here with problems, it can be very normalizing and liberating to at least understand, if I have problems, there are reasons why and where they come from. And the good thing is, if we can begin to understand it, how much more does God understand it, and how much more does He have solutions for us? So with that in mind, escape into your 45-minute lunch break, and we will look forward to seeing you shortly.